paper 15, section 5, old single column, page 170. All right, these next couple sections are a little bit more on the, you know, specific factual side. But they give this to us so that we have a little bit of assistance in knowing what the boundaries of variability are, you know, what the big picture looks like with in terms of all the different ways that things can do things in the greater cosmos. What are the basic ways that objects come into existence? There's obviously endless subcategories and whatnot, but they want to lay out just kind of the basic points so that it helps us to know how to cut through all of the complexity. Because if anyone's ever looked at photography of the heavens, it's just endless complexity. Okay. But there are some kind of basic modes of evolutionary operation that are in play, and they want to make sure we appreciate what those are, and then from that benchmark, we can expand on all of the epicycles, as it were, you know, of variability. So let's just jump in. We'll see right away that they're going to bring up a picture we looked at last week. So we'll think about that again.
5. The origin of space bodies. The bulk of the mass contained in the suns and planets of a superuniverse originates in the nebular wheels. Very little of superuniverse mass is organized by the direct action of the power directors, as in the construction of architectural spheres. Although a constantly varying quantity of matter originates in open space.
Okay, so that first little bit, make sure you appreciate what they're saying there about things like the architectural spheres. You know, they're saying that by and large, you don't have objects that are completely micromanaged into existence like that, you know, where every automaton is placed in position, okay? You know, by and large, the power beings and the force organizers are working with a broad brush and letting the natural, you know, laws take their course, by and large. But they're guiding the whole big picture because the whole purpose is to establish domains for creature existence, you know, both mortal creatures and otherwise. So you can't just let it do whatever the heck it wants. You have to guide it. But most of the time, that guiding is not so hyper-managed as the case of architectural spheres. We all know that the Revelators is working all through the book to help us help long-time religionists that have difficulty with the notion of evolution to get over that. You know, to understand that evolution is creativity in time. And they'll stress that as we get in a little bit even. But by and large, you can, within certain constraints where the beings are non-negligible in their footprint, things are kind of just doing gravity processes, you know, electromagnetic processes and whatnot, you know, to get things to come together. Now, that last little bit, see, although a constantly varying quantity of matter originates in open space, we've kind of alluded to that when we were talking about this whole segment of the superuniverse level that is the superuniverse of Ormantown, the seventh superuniverse. Yeah, it has this one great big spiral galaxy in the middle, the Milky Way galaxy, but there's a handful of little stuff scattered around it, you know, in the immediate vicinity, a lot of which is not even some tiny little whirl. It's just stuff that's collected together into big spherical collections, you know. So it's just totally under gravity direction, as it were. You don't have force organizers, you know, putting a whirl in place, which imposes a, you know, sort of a foundation upon everything that's going on. It's just out in open space where there's no whirl, but there's stuff, you know, everywhere. I mean, even in the process of forming stars in a little spiral galaxy out there like the Andromeda Nebula. I mean, there's going to be stuff, debris, scattered all over the place from that process. It's a, you know, most of these processes are messy. And so space is filled with stuff, okay? You know, I mean, including all the stuff that we don't currently recognize in physics. You know, there's ultimatons everywhere, okay? And, you know,
it's pervaded.
Right. So even... You know, even all the way down to that level, you have ultimons everywhere, and they'll slowly collect together in the collections of 100, and you know, you'll start making particles, and eventually you've got stars and collections of stars, you know, and that can all just kind of happen on its own. You know, there's no nudging or anything going on with from the power beings. Okay, so and constantly varying because it's, you know, it's sort of all the stuff that's going on in the cracks of of the big picture. So it's being buffeted about by all sorts of activity and whatnot. It's a, you know, there's nothing very methodical and uniform about it. But just appreciate that you know, that's certainly completely unrecognized in any current scientific notion that just out there in open space you could have matter come together.
By matter, do they mean?
They mean getting it all the way to atoms and molecules and yeah, and objects and whatnot.
Responsive to gravity.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
And like I was saying, that doesn't have to start out with dust particles or something. I mean, it can literally start out all the way with ultimatons and build up, you know, and everything in between.
So the scientists don't even recognize that the cold temperatures of space. They know it's cold in space, mm-hmm. but they don't recognize that the cold temperatures cause this, you know. The formulation of this matter coming together.
I mean, in current notion, you have sort of the initial matter coming into existence in the Big Bang,
yeah.
and then bigger constructs, you know, basically of hydrogen and a few other lighter things, bigger constructs being put together inside of stars. I mean, that's the basic notion of how matter is coming into existence.
So it's all heat generated.
Yeah, and so it's all very hot. Phenomena,
right.
Yeah,
right.
And obviously, you know, there's, you know, sometimes it's a hot environment too, but
right.
you know, in a very, very cold environment, this stuff can just slowly, you know, over long spans of time, come together, and maybe just mention that. I mean, we'll get into that explicitly in a little bit, but remember, there's vastly longer spans of time in play than any scientist imagines. So, very, very slow processes have plenty of time. You know, to come to fruition. Yeah. Yep.
I was under the impression that the whole Big Bang theory was pretty much passé now. That they have other theorems that they...
Oh, heavens no. I mean, it's the dogma. I mean, you know, there's always been, you know, a handful of contenders against it. You know...
Well, multiverses but, and bubble universes and
right, right, but all you know, but it all is predicated on some bang, you know, in one way or another, you know, a magical initiation, you know, an acausal initiation of some sort, you know, and I was going to say, I mean, you know, there's always been a measure of at least. Uncertainty about, you know, the absoluteness of this idea. I mean, that's why it's called the Big Bang. You know, that's a ridicule name, you know, that was adopted, you know, despite the ridiculer. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So yeah, you think you're ridiculing us calling it the Big Bang. Well, we're going to assume that name and we're going to glorify that name. You know, it's going to be a mark of greatness rather than the ridicule that you wanted it to be. I mean, it's so from day one, you know, pretty much see it's, but, you know, anyway, that whole notion that you can expect various things that you'll observe to be predicated on the formation of matter in a ubiquitous fashion. That's something that's not recognized. And so, you know, they observe things and they never even imagine of trying to explain it that way, because they have no idea that that's even possible. All right, so just a little, see, I'm just belaboring that, it seems, because the tiniest little phrase like that is quite revelatory, okay? Worldview reforming. I mean, just, you know, to understand how that could be, you have to change all of physics. Right? I mean, that's why that can be. That simple little statement.
So it's not just the Christians that need to expand their view. It's scientists too.
Can you name someone who doesn't need to totally reform their worldview? What topic is not discussed in the fifth ethical revelation? Not a heck of a lot of topics, right? Yeah. Everybody needs ethical revelation. Most worldviews are almost, you know, totally full of holes. All right, so now we'll get into this list of kind of some basic processes here.
As to origin, the majority of the suns, planets, and other spheres can be classified in one of the following 10 groups. 1, concentric contraction rings. Not all nebulae are spiral. Many, an immense nebula, instead of splitting into a double star system or evolving as a spiral, undergoes condensation by multiple ring formation. For long periods, such a nebula appears as an enormous central sun surrounded by numerous gigantic clouds of encircling ring-appearing formations of matter.
Okay, so a number of things there. I mean, in the midst of that paragraph, notice the basic scale and difference, mentioning a collection of matter that's only big enough to just make a double star on the one hand, all the way to the other end where you have some gigantic collection of matter that could make millions of stars, okay, and everything in between. You know, so as you're reading through this, it's not like you're going from bigger to smaller or anything like that. You're just sort of considering general processes, and they might work at many different scales, very large scales, very small scales. So the basic idea is, I mean, it's one thing to have the force organizers set up a whirl and get matter going within that whirl. It's another to just have a gigantic collection of gas, a big cloud of gas, maybe enough matter to make 10 million stars. You know, so, I mean, the little Andronovers spiral nebula only made about 1 million. You know, so, you know, when they say immense, I mean, yeah, it could be very immense. You could be talking about a very, very huge cloud of matter. You know, and we certainly observe these things. Within that giant cloud of gas, a lot of which is hydrogen, of course, just slowly, and maybe with some pushes from things going on in the environment around it, you get some condensation going. You get gravity starting to collect some of that gas together into a ball in the center. You know, and it collects and collects and collects and collects until finally it gets big enough that, you know, you've got a star-sized ball of gas that's sort of taking a cavity out of this big cloud. You have this big cloud, and you've got this little cavity forming as this gas is gravitationally condensing into a star in the middle of that bubble that you've kind of carved out now inside this giant cloud. And the star kicks off, starts giving off ultraviolet radiation that's energetic enough to ionize some of the hydrogen in the sort of the wall of this bubble that this star is down in the middle of. You know, it's going to light up that. It's going to ionize that some. It's going to light it up, you know, so you can see it from a distance. And so from a distance, you know, you're going to see this star with glowing gas, you know, and a spherical shell around it. But, of course, looking from a distance, you don't see a sphere. You're seeing two dimensions. And so it's very thin, the part that's glowing, so you don't see really anything in the center part. You just, when you're looking along the edges, you're looking through enough glowing gas that you can actually see it from many, many light years away. So you'll see a ring. Do you remember when we passed around this image of Barnard's galaxy? Remember the little red rings? Okay, that's what they're talking about in that section. They're literally talking about things like that ring nebula there. Yeah, and you look, and sure enough, there's a star in the middle of it. You know, here's another little ring. You can see the star right in the middle of it. You know, sometimes there's a number of stars, and so it's not just a simple little ring. But there's one that's sort of the most recent one, and so it's pretty much a ring with that one at the center, but you've got a few other hot ones in there you can see, and so there's kind of some overlaid, you know. That's what they're basically talking about. You know, and it's not like there's just gas that you can see. There's a huge amount of gas there, most likely, that's not glowing. Okay, so you can't see it. There's just that one little area right around that newbie star, you know, and it's lighting it up so that you can see it. Okay, that's what they're talking about. So for a long period of time, you can see those sorts of ring-like formations. If you look in that zoom in on the Milky Way, you know, you can see little, you know, just exactly like that. You know, typical reddish color there is from hydrogen, a line of hydrogen, you know, putting off light.
I'm gonna ask you, would Hoag's object be one of those?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of other reasons that there's rings, too. Okay, you might have a star that is putting off material. It's losing a bunch of its material, and that's collecting in a great big shell around it. So, you know, you could see something glowing that went out rather than, you know, what didn't go in. You know,
but
there's all kinds of different ways that you can obviously get something that's spherically symmetric, because gravity is spherically symmetric. It acts in every direction, so you invariably form various kinds of spherical structures, whether or not stuff is going, you know, out radially or inward radially. You can get various spherical structures that from a distance you're just going to see a ring, because they're too thin to, you know, for it to be so much glowing, you know, in the front of you that you can't see the star in the middle. You know, it's just very thin. You see right through that. And it's only where it's optically thick enough, there's enough of it, you know, and you're looking along the edge of it. Okay, so they're just reminding you that one of the ways that you can make stars is just a simple gravitational condensation out of a great big cloud, and it's that phenomenon isn't embedded in this very dominating whirl phenomenon. It's just kind of just sitting there. Okay. All right.
Two, the world stars embrace those suns which are thrown off the great mother wheels of highly heated gases. They are not thrown off as rings, but in right and left-handed processions. World stars are also of origin in other than spiral nebulae.
Like BARD, yeah, galaxies, I think they're going to mention in the next sentence. But, okay, so that's basically what we just read about in the last section. You know, and there is that mystery that, you know, you get something, you know, all this gas going around in a whirl, and, you know, it gets to the point where, you know, it wants to fling off stuff, and it doesn't just do it at every tangent so that you end up scattering stuff in a ring all the way around. This very curious bipolar, you know, out of opposite sides, you know, which tends to make those bars in the first place, and then wrap into spiral arms. And that phenomenon of why, you notice they're not explaining it there. That there's some real mystery there. Probably, you know, involving, you know, the fact that there is this transcendent phenomenon that's engaging this matter, that whirl. Remember, that whirl is coming down from the high reaches of the absinthe down into the finite. I mean, you have a transfinite phenomenon that's engaging the finite. The automatons are pushing on the force charge, and the force charge is pushing on the automatons. You know, I mean, there's this coupling, this dynamic coupling. of finite phenomena to transfinite, to a degree, phenomena. And what's the physics of that? I don't know, but that would be one of my first suspicions, is maybe the mystery is something to do with this, it may be a geometric thing. How does absolute geometry couple to finite geometry? What kind of a footprint does it leave? In the midst of all this finite dynamics that's going on, but not left to be merely finite dynamics, it's being influenced some by transfinite dynamics. What does that do? That's a mystery that needs to be solved. And you notice that they're not just telling us. So it's something that we can figure out once we start to take a hold of the actual facts of what galaxies are about, that there's this whirl and the force charge and all that. We should be able to put that together.
3, gravity explosion planets. When a sun is born of a spiral or of a barred nebula, not infrequently, it is thrown out a considerable distance. Such a sun is highly gaseous, and subsequently, after it has somewhat cooled and condensed, it may chance to swing near some enormous mass of matter, a gigantic sun or a dark island of space. Such an approach may not be near enough to result in collision, but still near enough to allow the gravity pull of the greater body to start tidal convulsions in the lesser, thus initiating a series of tidal upheavals which occur simultaneously on opposite sides of the convulsed sun. At their height, these explosive eruptions produce a series of varying-sized aggregations of matter which may be projected beyond the gravity reclamation zone of the erupting sun, thus becoming stabilized in orbits of their own around one of the two bodies concerned in this episode. Later on, the larger collections of matter unite and gradually draw the smaller bodies to themselves. In this way, many of the solid planets of the lesser systems are brought into existence. Your own solar system had just such an origin.
Okay, so the key that's not stated explicitly there about why you get this tidal disruption like that is this young solitary star is a variable star. Like our sun started out as a variable star just prior, and it had a period of pulsation. This is a literal radial, pulsation of the entire object heaving like this, in a 3.5-day cycle, just prior to the Angana system passing by like this. Okay, so you have our sun pulsating like this, and in comes this object and starts pulling on it, and it's a simple tidal pull, just like the moon pulls on the on the oceans of the Earth. So you have a tide on the near side and a tide on the opposite side, because you're pulling the water, the close water, more than you're pulling the center of the Earth, so you make a differential there. And you're pulling the center of the Earth more than you're pulling the far water, so you make a differential there. So you bulge it out, see, on both sides. Okay, so the same thing happens to the sun. Gets bulged out on both sides, and it's still a variable star. It's still pulsating. Gets in closer and closer. I mean, there's going to come a point probably where, blah, you actually break some stuff free, okay? And like you're saying, it has some potential escape velocity here, so that it doesn't just go, and throw up and fall back down again. It actually gets out and goes into orbit, okay? And, we all know that's the way our solar system got started. There was a great big tongue of matter, big, thick in the middle and tapering on both ends. The thick in the middle point, that's where Jupiter condensed, and then the smaller stuff going, towards the ends of the taper, both directions. Most of the stuff that broke off on the opposite side didn't really escape and ended up mostly getting collected back in and, or getting picked up by the planets eventually and stuff.
How did Jupiter get all the way out there if it started closer to the sun?
No, I mean, it pulled that tongue all the way out. okay? And that tongue is thicker, you know. Is kind of think of it, you know, it's basically trying to, it's pulling a blob out. That's the thick part. But there's tapers on each side, okay? So, you know, you just about made a double star by pulling off a big glob and making a little star out of it. Jupiter is almost big enough, you know, to be a tiny star. Okay. All right, so, but the key there is that they don't mention explicitly is, you know, obviously you need to have some sort of a potential instability. You need this star pulsating like this so that it can get tugged on and, you know, one of those out motions breaks free.
Has that been guessed at by scientists?
No, I mean, you could certainly guess at that, but they just, you know, they've convinced themselves that the way our solar system formed is it was just one of these great big clouds of gas, you know, that slowly condensed into a star in the middle, and the stuff that didn't end up getting all the way into the middle just ended up collecting, you know, farther out and making planets. You know, and you could certainly do that, but that isn't the way ours formed. And the way the reason you can really tell that is that tongue of matter. Okay, I mean, if my thumb is the axis of rotation of the sun, and the Angana system didn't, you know, come in right in the equatorial plane of the rotation of the sun. It was at an angle, and so that tongue, you know, didn't pull out in the equatorial plane of the rotation of the sun. Now, the plane that the planets are in is inclined relative to the equator of the sun, which really tells you that's the way it formed. But they argue that away.
What about the retrograde spin on the planets? They don't.
Oh, and then, well, yeah, you could mention that as a little subtext in here. The fact that there's kind of three primary retrograde phenomena in our solar system is because our sun captured three, you know, objects. Three planets from the Angana system. See, and that brought in some non-conformal motion into the system.
Do we know which three?
Well, Venus. I mean, it's, you know, Venus obviously got hit, and Uranus got hit and tipped on its side. And Triton is that third object. The Neptune captured that third little object. It's now a moon of Neptune going in a retrograde orbit. And of course, when it did that, it most likely flung the natural moons of Neptune out of the system. And that's some of those smaller objects that we see out there now, you know, in the neighborhood of Pluto. You know, most likely, you know, a handful of those used to be Neptune's moons until that object, you know, disrupted the Neptune system and threw them out. All right.
Four, centrifugal planetary daughters. Enormous suns, when in certain stages of development and if their revolutionary rate greatly accelerates, begin to throw off large quantities of matter which may subsequently be assembled to form small worlds that continue to encircle the parent sun.
Yeah, so there they're talking about something you can see flung out in every direction, you know. Like they were alluding to, you don't have in the spiral galaxy, you get this bar thing. You know, there you just imagine something spinning so fast that stuff is flinging out in every direction. Everyone has experienced that. I mean, you know, you go to the fair and they plop paint on the little spinning, you know, circle. Yeah, I mean, that's the way those happen, right?
Funny how they call it daughters.
Right, and the reason they're doing that is, you know, they're calling mother, you know, they're using the mother wheel, you know, the whole notion of it's a womb for stars, you know, and so the mother gives rise to daughters. They're just, you know, using that analogy.
Gravity deficiency spheres.
Yes.
There is a critical limit to the size of individual stars. When a sun reaches this limit, unless it slows down in revolutionary rate, it is doomed to split. Sun fission occurs, and a new double star of this variety is born. Numerous small planets may be subsequently formed as by a byproduct of this gigantic disruption.
There's all kinds of debris. Yeah. So, I mean, that's just, obviously, you could have enough matter that's condensing and spinning ever faster like the skater, you know, pulling in its arms, that there's not enough gravity to hold it all together, and it just, you know, breaks apart into two blobs that go into orbit about each other.
Six contractual stars. In the smaller systems, the largest outer planet sometimes draws to itself its neighboring worlds, while those planets near the sun begin their terminal plunge. With your solar system, such an end would mean that the four inner planets would be claimed by the sun, while the major planet, Jupiter, would be greatly enlarged by capturing the remaining worlds. Such an end of a solar system would result in the production of two adjacent but unequal suns, one type of double star formation. Such catastrophes are infrequent except out on the fringe of the superuniverse starry aggregations.
See, so they're pointing out the contrast. Instead of getting a double star where the, you know, it splits in two, you know, in halves, so that you have basically two identical sized stars, you could use, this process could give you very different sized stars in the end. Now, why does this really only happen way out on the fringes, like they're saying? You know, in close, this is all highly managed space. You've got all these solar systems with inhabited worlds and all this. I mean, that space is managed. You know, you're not going to let that solar system, you know, come under disruptive influences where this contracting would happen. And, you know, just to note that, you know, that word contract, see how they say outer planet sometimes draws? You know, the tract part means draw, and then C-O-N is together, you know. So just the idea of you have two dominant objects that draw all the stuff in their environment together into them. You know, they're trying to use the language in its very literal sense like that so that you have these definitive terms. You know, that's certainly a possibility that a scientist recognizes that, you know, that that could have happened. The Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars could have gotten captured by the sun, and everything else could have collected together, and Jupiter would have been big enough then to ignite and be a star itself.
So okay. Does that mean that, you know, if that were to happen, that the first four planets would get sucked into the sun? Is that what they're saying?
Right, yeah, they're just pointing out you can just get everything collected together into two blobs instead of a whole bunch of, you know, smaller blobs. Yeah.
So would that take a long time?
Well, yeah, I mean, most likely this sort of thing would be like, you know, way out on the fringes. Something is out there. There's a solar system. It's not being used for an inhabited world, you know, and just eons are going by. It's being buffeted about by various things, you know. I mean, little disruptions, even internal tensions, tidal tensions can, you know, slowly alter orbits, you know, and something could get, you know, on the process of starting to really spiral in. Yeah, so that's just all they're talking about.
Seven, cumulative spheres. From the vast quantity of matter circulating in space, small planets may slowly accumulate. They grow by meteoric accretion and by minor collisions. In certain sectors of space, conditions favor such forms of planetary birth. Many an inhabited world has had such an origin. Some of the dense dark islands are the direct result of the accretions of transmuting energy in space. Another group of these dark islands have come into being by accumulation of enormous quantities of cold matter, mere fragments and meteors, circulating through space. Such aggregations of matter have never been hot and, except for density, are in composition very similar to Urantia.
Okay, so you've got a number of things that they're all sticking together there. One thing, them using the word accretion here in contrast to condensation. So, you know, you're going to use the word condense when you just have some big distribution of gas that's going to get more dense, you know, and intensified densification, okay, is what condensation means, okay? You know, so that's just, you know, coming together by gravity and getting denser and denser and denser in some way. But when you say accretion, you don't want to think of a distribution that's getting denser like that. You want to just think of a bunch of little like objects, like a whole bunch of little dust particles, say, in a vast distribution. And slowly, you know, these things are rattling around and two dust particles stick together and then three stick together and then four stick together. And so you use that word accretion when you're thinking about a bunch of little things that are just accumulating. Yeah, see? And so that's the difference of terminology there. Now, notice that, you know, I say many inhabited world has had such an origin. They pick that, the rest of the story up in the next section. But, you know, they're reminding you that a lot of the worlds that are now inhabited didn't form in the immediate environment of the star. It's just this object that condensed out in the middle of nowhere and eventually got captured by a star. And it was in just such a fortuitous orbit about that sun. Hey, we can use that one. You know, they're constantly looking, and they're using every single object that's usable. They take it on as basically a challenge. You know, the life carriers. I mean, to see just how many different objects they can turn into inhabited spheres. You know, and they push the limits in every direction, and it doesn't matter if that ball of dirt came from far away or not. It's completely irrelevant. But it is interesting to see to know that many an inhabited world. So in order to get this cold little object like the Earth that you can have for an inhabited sphere, it's pretty easy to make cold little objects out in cold space. So not coincident, you know, not too mysteriously. That's exactly how a lot of them formed.
How do they get the water here?
Well, again, I mean, there's water everywhere.
It's just a gas.
No. Well, remember, when we're saying gas, I mean, you have all kinds of atoms, including hydrogen and oxygen atoms, and they come together and they make water. The water of the Earth didn't somehow get shipped in from some water reservoir. It's part of the sun. There's lots of hydrogen and oxygen in the sun, you know, and you can make water out of it.
But, I mean, they have to get the hydrogen and the oxygen here.
No, this object is collecting out in space, and it's got water.
It's all there.
It's all there. Yeah. Then the whole issue now of dark islands of space. Okay, the latter part there, is just saying, yeah, not only little things that could be an inhabited world collect like this, but, you know, sometimes really, really great big things. Okay, so that's pretty obvious that, you know, you could have enough accretion like this that you could make one of these gigantic dark islands of space. You know, the subtext, of course, there is, we've mentioned a number of times, you know, enormous quantities, okay? We'll pick up the details, but, just remember, current scientists don't think you can make enormous quantities of cold matter and have it be an object. They think it goes magical and turns into a black hole, okay? We'll get to that in a minute. The really interesting thing is that first little passing sentence that's not elaborated on. Some of the dense dark islands are the direct result of the accretions of transmuting energy in space. Okay. We were talking about how, you know, you can certainly have automatons coming together and all this sort of stuff, you know, on its own. So you might just think, oh, they're just saying that it could start not from, like, dust grains and little meteors collecting together, but all the way to automatons collecting together. But it should feel a little weird, and we'll pick that up again a little bit too. I mean, the thing that it should make you suspicious of is that maybe when you're talking about transmuting energy in space, Maybe there's a little bit of catalytic over-control going on here. Maybe the primary associators, that one flavor of master physical controllers, are injecting themselves a little bit into this process, and you'll see why that's highly likely when we get down the road here a little bit. And that also kind of ties into, in the very first paragraph of the section, you know, when they say direct action of the power directors, as in the construction of architectural spheres, you know, you notice to say, it doesn't just say the construction of architectural spheres. It says as in other words, there might be other things that have a little bit of tweaking going on, a little bit more micromanagement going on. Okay. All
right. Eight, burned out suns. Some of the dark islands of space are burned out isolated suns, all available space energy having been emitted. The organized units of matter approximate full condensation, virtual complete consolidation, and it requires ages upon ages for such enormous masses of highly condensed matter to be recharged in the circuits of space and thus to be prepared for new cycles of universe function following a collision of some equally revivifying cosmic happening.
So a collision or some equally revivifying cosmic happening. For instance, you know, right after they tell you about the primary associators that I just alluded to, they tell you about the secondary dissociators. Occasionally, those secondary dissociators will actually intervene in, you know, the normal run-of-the-mill things and unravel something. You know, if you just have all of this energy locked up in this, you know, ultimatonic crystal, basically, this burnt-out star, you know, it's not any good for anyone. And they just go in there with some heavy-duty anti-gravity presence and, you know, diffuse it back into the system. Now, this is also, if you have any experience with astronomy, you know that scientists talk about such things. They call them black dwarfs, because remember, they call little stars dwarf stars. You know, so they talk about this notion, and they call it a black dwarf. But they, you know, if you read about it, they'll say, but there aren't any such objects. Why do they believe that there are no such objects when they can obviously see that it's a possibility? Because they can do mathematics. They can calculate how long it would take something that wasn't generating energy anymore to cool off to the point where it was just a cinder sitting there, you know, pretty much at absolute zero, you know, at space temperature. Okay? You know, and the back of the envelope calculation maybe gets an answer something like 1,000 trillion years or something. Okay? Regardless of, you know, how valid a number that is, you know, they know that it would obviously have to be trillions and trillions and trillions of years before such a thing could come into existence. Well, they believe that the universe is only 13.75 billion years old. You know, they think the Big Bang was 13.75 billion years ago. So the reason they don't believe that there are any black dwarfs is because there isn't enough time to make one. Okay, but there are lots of them. You know, and you know, it's convenient for the current ignorance. Obviously, it's not giving off any light or heat, so you're not going to see it. So there's no inconvenient fact that's going to mess up your current, you know, theory. But yeah, they're just pointing out, no, the universe has been around for who knows how many trillions of years, plenty of time for a lot of stars to go totally to cinders. Okay. Black dwarfs. Yep.
So a collision to make that happen, would it be a collision with another?
Yeah, you could have two, you know, black dwarfs slam together and, you know, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise,
yeah.
One
Right, right. Yeah.
Wouldn't do anything to it.
Yeah, right.
Chunk of coal.
Yeah.
Laughing.
Right. Exactly. All right.
9. Collisional spheres. In those regions of thicker clustering, collisions are not uncommon. Such an astronomic readjustment is accompanied by tremendous energy changes and matter transmutations. Collisions involving dead suns are peculiarly influential in creating widespread energy fluctuations. Collisional debris often constitutes the material nucleuses for the subsequent formation of planetary bodies adapted to mortal habitation.
So again, you can have this debris, you know, and a chunk of it just happens to be just the right size and gets captured by a sun, and that ends up being, you know, used for an inhabited world. You know, and there's your two, you know, cinders colliding together.
So they would have to liberate all of that condensation.
You know, you may have an object that's not hyper-dense all the way out to the surface. So there could be some fluffier debris. Okay. But even the more crystallized stuff, you know, is going to be heavily disrupted. Now, it's getting hit with Thor's hammer here, and so it's going to get broken, even though, you know, it's very dense. So, you know, once you break it out of that intense gravity environment that's, you know, keeping it held together like that, then, you know, okay, yeah, it can breathe again, and yeah. Yeah, I mean, just
so it can't be like that.
Don't ever, right, yeah, right, just don't ever forget that the only reason any of this is possible is gravity, you know, can build up to the immense pressures that can, you know,
that can
hold this sort of structure together like this. I mean, normally, you know, it has room to breathe, and so, you know, it isn't packed together like this.
Seems obvious that if there were such collisions that were resulting in material nucleuses, those things wouldn't always just happen to fortuitously be exactly spherical. I mean, they might come out looking like a real
right, but yeah, they'll start out, you know, as some oddball chunk, but they'll, you know, gravity molds them into a sphere again because gravity is spherical. You know, I mean, it's just like with you look at the fifth planet that got ripped apart by Jupiter, okay? When you look at all the asteroids, all the debris, most of that debris is too small to remold itself into a sphere again. But the biggest chunk of that planet that's left is the little, you know, what we now call a dwarf planet, Ceres. I mean, that's a sphere. I mean, you see, there was enough matter there, no matter what kind of oddball shape it was when it got ripped apart, you know, it molded itself back into a sphere again. Ceres? Like grain, like cereal, you know, that god. Yeah. So, when you look at the asteroids, you know, there's just a critical limit when you finally have enough mass that no matter what shape it started out as, it's molded itself into a sphere again. You know, one of the things that that's I've always been curious about when they talk about all these various ways that you might get a planet that you're going to put mortals on. You know, we think of sort of the normal thing as a planet like ours, where we have all this plate tectonics and all this sort of stuff. And I mean, it's a lot of these processes, you know, are pretty chaotic here. I mean, it always makes me wonder, I mean, just how different a world can you have and have it still end up being something that will work for kind of the run-of-the-mill inhabited sphere? I mean, yeah, non-breather worlds, you know, okay, whatever. But, like when you think about, if they had terraformed Venus and made a super breather world out of Venus, you know, you'd have a very different inhabited world there because you don't have any plate tectonics there. You don't have, apparently, there's no sign of plate tectonics there. Do they work with worlds like that?
Well, all the people that would come out of there would be morbidly depressed. They'd have to work with them for eons to get them shaped up psychologically.
They would have terraformed it, okay? It would have been a beautiful place. The reason it's ugly right now is because it wasn't terraformed. Beauty doesn't just magically come out of nowhere. Beauty is the mark of beings. If you see beauty anywhere on the earth, it's because beings are behind that. Okay. So anyway, there's. That's a kind of a technical detail, but you know, if you have any interest in kind of the details of these sorts of things, that's a kind of a curious question about just how different the internal dynamics of a world can be and have it be kind of a typical inhabited world. I have no idea how to think about that.
Especially for the flying humans and the ones that live in water and the ones that live just in the air.
Right, but remember, that's pre-human stuff. You know, by the time when you're talking about humans, you're talking about bipedal, land-based. You may start with animals that were in the air, or start with animals in the water, but by the time you got to have something that mates with an Adam and Eve. There aren't fish Adam and Eves or bird Adam and Eves. You know, there's just Adam and Eve who stand on dirt, you know, and walk on 2 feet.
But Michael makes each. I know I've heard this in the study group before, but now I've thought. That
go back and read that. You'll see it's a little bit different than you. Some people think it is.
And I realize that Michael makes the Adam and Eves to fit.
Right, but you've got in Satania, in our local system, you will have inhabited worlds where the humans on those worlds came through a marine or an air, you know, animal predecessor process. You only have one group of Adam and Eves on Gerasim.
Right. Yeah, but there's other systems that are different.
Right.
It makes them different for different systems.
Yeah, but again, they point out that you don't have that kind of variation. You don't have fish people. Humans that are living in the water or living in the air. By the time they're humans, they're on the ground.
Okay.
And that's it. That's in the book, yeah. All right.
Number 10, architectural worlds. These are the worlds which are built according to plans and specifications for some special purpose, such as Selvington, the headquarters of your local universe, and Uversa, the seat of government for our super-universe. There are numerous other techniques for evolving suns and segregating planets, but the foregoing procedures suggest the methods whereby the vast majority of stellar systems and planetary families are brought into existence. To undertake to describe all of the various techniques involved in stellar metamorphosis and planetary evolution would require the narration of almost 100 different modes of sun formation and planetary origin. As your star students scan the heavens, they will observe phenomena indicative of all these modes of stellar evolution, but they will seldom detect evidence of the formation of those small, non-luminous collections of matter which serve as inhabited planets, the most important of the vast material creations.
Why, even though they're small, why are they the most important? Why does the universe exist? To be inhabited. The only reason the universe exists is to be inhabited. You don't just have things, you also have value. And value is not a quantitative fact. You know, just because it's big doesn't mean it has value. They're just trying to remind you that, you know, in the midst of talking about all this material stuff, big and small, don't forget, this is pervaded by value, and the two are brought into relationship. And by and large, where value meets thing, value, where value meets thing and there's meaning, is on small little worlds like ours. Not on some big grandiose thing that makes a fancy picture through the Hubble telescope or something. Okay? The little things that by and large we'll never see from this vantage point because they're just too small. That's you know, and that's the very first thing that they give us in the Urantia book is a new designation to call ourselves by, a designation of truth rather than merely fact. We use a factual term to refer to where we live. We call this the earth, you know, the dirt we stand on, okay, the earth. And it's like, well, yeah, that's kind of prosaic, isn't it? You know, it's basically what they're saying. What about the truth of where you stand? You stand on a place in the heavens, you know, a place in a cosmos, in the cosmos. Okay, that's the truth of where you stand. See, so, you know, that's a subtext of just what they're pointing out there. Don't get in such a materialistic mode where you judge the value of something by its physical size.
Now, what you just explained, does that also apply to the other six super universes whose focus is not exclusively on the
ascension scheme? Sure, everyone has a heavenly place. Everyone has a place in the cosmos. I mean, you can, you know, just forget about pondering what those other six schemes are. Just think about the difference between a father fuser and a spirit fuser. For long, long ages, for a spirit-fused mortal, their local universe is their place in the heavens. I mean, how long is this your place in the heavens? You know, don't blink, you'll miss it. I mean, this is a... just a fleeting moment here, you know. But, you know, will you think about the local universe as your place in the heavens when you've been living there for 100 trillion years? Yeah, slightly. You know, so those spirit-fused mortals, you know, really have a very strong relationship with place. They're a much more place-like, mother-like phenomenon than an ascender. It's much more of a direction-like, father-like phenomenon. But of course, eventually, you know, we're done with our ascension and we're done with really that direction, that father-like, you know, God the Father seeking. We're done with that father mode. You know, and we go into a mother-like mode, you know, and our place is the entire grand universe. And we've got to flesh out our relationship with the whole thing. Yeah. That penetration of the whole to the point of completion. You've got the ascension to perfection. You got a huge task after paradise to penetrate to completion. To fully manifest the potential relationship to the whole that you're revivified with while you're on paradise. You know, they remember they mentioned you come into a new revivifying relationship with the eternal mother, son. You know, and begin this process of beginning to manifest what your real destiny is, to be an individual that expresses that other type of individuality, the mother type of individual. You know, she's the individuality of the whole, and you take an oath as a finaliter to the Paradise Trinity, to the source of mother deity, and you know, and take on this expression of becoming in your little degree, your little measure, an expression of an individuality of the whole. In the context of the individuality of the whole, you know, God the Supreme is God the Mother, But you too will be an individuality of the whole. Okay. So the Father is the individuality of the parts. The Mother is the individuality of the whole. It's two types of individuality. And from our bottom-up perspective, we start out, the Father initiates us as a part. He gives us that the kind of individuality that makes us a part, because he's the individuality of the parts. He's the source of the individuality of the parts. He gives you that, initiates you. You work up from individuality through associativity to unity, working through the local universe and the super universe. You finally establish that full unity, relationship with that unity ceiling. And then, like we said, then you go into Avona and you put the ceiling on the floor. Okay? And you begin the process of working to that, from our perspective, what is a transcendent individuality. From unity up through associativity to a new transcendent individuality, an individuality of the whole. Now there's descending phenomena that are, they start out as being an individuality of the whole, and they're working to become an individuality that's a part. Okay, so their transcendent individuality is the part-like individual. Our transcendent individuality is the whole-like individual. There's two flavors of individuality. Because they're trying to come down into relationship with that Father individuation within the whole. Okay? That's how we start, but that's not our destiny. Okay? That's a huge part of what the fifth epical revelation is about. Mankind has never had any notion of, what's on the other side of the unity mirror, that there's a mirror domain, see? That's our destiny. Our destiny is not to take an oath to the Father or the Son or the Spirit or even to all three of them. Our destiny is to take an oath to the Paradise Trinity, because our destiny is to be an individuality of the whole. That's our destiny.
It seems like beings coming down the opposite way are looking at getting worse and less perfect.
No. See, that's what I mean. See, that's what it seems like to us. It seems like they're going retrograde, they're retrogressing. See, that's a bias of your viewpoint.
Yeah.
Turn around.
You have an example. You have an example of a descending phenomenon.
I've been where you're going.
Who do we call him? We have we know an example of a descending phenomenon. What do we call him?
Jesus.
Okay. What do they tell you in the Jesus papers when he finally reaches bottom? For him, he's reached the apex. He's reached full transcendence. From us, it's like, no, you're down literally in the blood and the mud and the, what do you mean, transcendence? Okay, that's what I'm trying to escape. It's like, no, that's what I'm trying to achieve. That is the most transcendent domain that I can get to. See, you must begin to see the bidirectional nature. Okay? And the one that's a little bit more in the mode we were just talking, take the Creative Mother Spirit. It's a great example of a condensation phenomenon. Starts out just by nature, by an initial state as being an individuality of the whole. And she is working on condensing and becoming a part. Like right now, she's not a part. She's a whole. She's the one turning of the local universe. Okay? She's the whole. She's working towards a transcendent state of transcending that whole and becoming a part that can literally stand next to the Creator Son, take his hand, and they can go out to the outer space levels. That's the transcendent goal she's working toward, part-likeness. Okay? We start with part-likeness, and if we are hyper-spiritually biased in your viewpoint, you tend to think of parts as the last thing you'd want to strive for. You're trying to to let go of your partness. Okay?
Evolution, though, one is not devolution. One is not devolving. She's not devolving.
She's evolving. Right. We're both evolving. It's just evolution is bidirectional. You know, and there's transcendence both ways. The finite is absolutely transcendent of the absolute from a top-down viewpoint. From a bottom-up viewpoint, the absolute is absolutely transcendent of the finite. Transcendence is in both directions. That's the fifth epical revelation.
Going back to spirit fusers, do we have any on our planet?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly could be some here that are working, you know.
So they're going to be naturally more place-like, not only in their genetics, but also in their orientation and spirit.
You know, yeah. Remember, there's all kinds of different roles that they, you know, can take on, especially once they finally have become part of the Nebadon core of completion. You know, they ascend to, in our case, Salvington. You know, they ascend to the local universe headquarters, okay, and they are inducted into the Nebadon core perfection. You know, they're done with their ascension leg. They've ascended to perfection. Then they go into the next phase, their second phase, of penetrating to completion. Once they've penetrated the whole local universe and are complete, then they're inducted into the Nebadon core of completion. And at that point, they can start, you know, be assigned some really serious responsibilities in the local universe. Because they are a secure representation of the whole.
The beauty, you know, that planet that is ugly has no being created it, but anything that was beautiful was created by, I've never heard that before.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, if you actually went to Venus, there would be physical forms that would strike you as beautiful. But of course, you know, we all know that God is behind everything. I mean, the only reason that there's any form of any form, you know, is because God is behind things. I mean, even the beauty of a huge collection of stars coming together into this majestic spherical collection. I mean, they don't do that themselves. Gravity does that. And where does gravity come from? The aisle, okay? And who has a hold of the aisle? The Father, you know, okay? So any order of any kind, even that simple spherical order, you know, that can strike you as beautiful, I mean, it's because there's a person behind it, okay? And certainly, you know, when you walk around here and see beautiful plants and whatnot, I mean, that didn't do that itself. I mean, beauty is the hallmark of personality. Start from your top-down point of view. God is love. God is a person. Right? Downstep love into its sort of primal three facets of expression. What are they?
Truth,
beauty, and goodness. Beauty, okay? Beauty comes as one of the facets of love, and love is God. God is a person. I mean, it's a fundamental personal fact. There is no beauty without personality. You've been given personality. You've been given the opportunity to be an agent of beauty. As a matter of fact, that's what your initial ascension project is here, to go from beauty through truth to goodness. So those people who are trying to get to goodness but think they don't need to worry about beauty or truth are delusional. If you don't have beauty first, you're not getting anywhere. From beauty through truth to goodness, period. That's the only path to goodness. If you have not beauty, there'll never be genuine goodness. There'll only be delusions of goodness, okay? And then when you get to Havona, remember what they said. They start with goodness, from goodness through truth to beauty. That transcendent thing. Well, you know, we're going to be working on that too, like I was just saying. There was some. Who was? Oh, yeah.
Well, in a terrestrial life like this, personal beauty is so much an accident. So you've got to be talking about some other kind of beauty that we can create.
In supremacy, there are no accidents. yeah, but right. I mean, but think about why there is a lot of genetic ugliness. It's because of the rebellion and the default. If things had gone the normal process, by this point, by and large, you know, there would be beauty. You know, we would all be extensively, adamically uplifted and very masterfully blended into a magnificent, majestic race instead of a random pile of marbles that have, you know, are rattling around like they are now. Okay? Right, so, I mean, there's no ugly material sons and daughters. Yeah. They are gorgeous specimens.
And there are objective beauty. It's not beauty. It's in
right.
The eyes
of if it's in the eye of the beholder, it's not genuine beauty. It's delusion, you know, or bias. We're talking, see, beauty comes from the top down. It's objective. It doesn't come from the bottom up. It's not subjective. See, what you're in search of is true beauty. Beauty that you don't have to convince anyone of. Beauty that you don't need a marketing campaign, you know, to get into place. You know, you really should be really fascinated with this piece of art because, you know, and they spin this whole yarn for you, you know, or the label on the wine bottle or something and all that froth, okay? I mean, that's an attempt to manufacture beauty, okay, out of nothing, you know? It's false beauty.
I'm thinking about this girl that I went to high school with who was born with physical things wrong with her, and right now she's my age and she's slumped over in a wheelchair and she looks like she's 90, and she's probably not going to live too much longer.
Mm-hmm.
But she was always such a lovely person and really smart.
Lovely inside, see?
Really smart.
A little bit of time produces what result? In just a few years, that person will look on the outside like she does on the inside. She'll have a marancha body.
So you're talking about beauty that we need to, I mean, it doesn't all have to start right here. The beauty that begins here can be in our mind.
Now, the very fact that when you recognize that it's coming down from eternity, you can't expect to find it in some tiny little circumscribed segment of time. You know, the greater the beauty, the more of an eternal vantage point you have to see it. Yeah. We're going to miss a lot of the beauty on our way from here to paradise. When we come back out again, we'll have new eyes. We'll see beauty that we couldn't see before. The whole universe will have become new in our eyes, much more beautiful than we ever saw it on the way up. Because we'll literally have within us eternity consciousness. We can directly see things from an eternity viewpoint. That will be very interesting. What will things look like? You know, you're still a finite being, yes. So it's not, you know, you haven't transcended everything. But you have an inner vantage point subsequent to paradise that you didn't have even anywhere in Avona. You remember that? It's that last two circuits of Avona where you're trying to go through that aggressive, steep climb process to get, you know, all the way up through the absonite, the ultimate, the co-absolute, to the absolute. You know? So you'll have an amazing vantage point from which to finally recognize beauty. Might be fun to do a little bit more. Maybe we'll just do a first few little paragraphs here.
Okay.
Six, the spheres of space. Yeah. Irrespective of origin, the various spheres of space are classifiable into the following major divisions. One, the suns, the stars of space. Two, the dark islands of space. Three, minor space bodies, comets, meteors, planetesimals. Four, the planets, including the inhabited worlds. Five, architectural spheres, worlds made to order. With the exception of the architectural spheres, all space bodies have had an evolutionary origin. evolutionary in the sense that they have not been brought into being by fiat of deity, evolutionary in the sense that the creative acts of God have unfolded by a time-space technique through the operation of many of the created and eventuated intelligences of deity.
See, remember I told you that was they were going to come back to that little bit of creativity and time thing about evolution. And you know, and reminding you that it isn't in just a kind of a straightforward way that evolution is creativity and time. It isn't just as simple as the fiat finger snap that they're referring to there, slowed down, as it were, so that you can see all the details of it, you know, stretched out over time, and that's what we call evolution. Yes, there's that aspect to it, but there's more than just the Father involved in the creative act. There's other creative, you know, creator beings. Plus, there's all of their hands and feet and arms and whatnot. You know, all of the aids to creation, these created and eventuated intelligences of deity, like we were just talking about. Worlds don't form themselves. Architectural spheres don't construct themselves. You know, and probably a whole bunch of subtle little tweakings, you know, don't do that themselves. Not to mention when we were going through all of the details of the structure of the Milky Way galaxy as it actually is, with major sectors and minor sectors and local universes and all that. I mean, none of that happens naturally, okay? You know, it is all managed. Mind made and personality managed. So, you know, that is a huge step for just about everyone on the planet to come to terms with various parts of that paragraph. The non-purely fiat and the others and whatnot.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, there's divinity that isn't personalized. So, it, you know, personalized deity is God, but there's divinity that isn't personalized, that isn't deity. That makes up.
Well, there's also deity that's not personalized, too.
Okay.
Like the Paradise Trinity.
Right. I think what I'm trying to say is they talk about this as though there's actually a living presence in all of this material, sons and daughters and.
Oh, okay. In that sense, I mean, sure. I mean, that's basically. That there is a person behind the whole. There is an individuality of the whole. There's God the Mother. I mean, there's certainly that subtle divinity in nature, as it were. You know, we've talked about that before. I mean, so coincidentally, we have the expression mother, you know, Mother Nature.
It's not just poetic anthropomorphism. There's a reality when they're taught that way.
Right. I mean.
They describe it that way.
Right. I mean, you're looking in, you know, in a certain way. You can think of when you look out at the heavens, all the objects, structures of the heavens. You're to a degree looking at someone's body, but you know, and that's most pronounced when you're literally in a portion of that whole that is universized. you know, when you look out in the outer space levels, it looks pretty chaotic. It doesn't look like a beautiful internal body structure. Things are slamming together. It's like if that was someone's body, they would be diseased and dying. You can't have your internal organs, you know, slamming together and being ripped apart. And okay, galaxies are doing that out in the outer space levels. In here, in the super universe space level, there's a high degree of order, divinity, see, that you can begin to notice. And that's actually, see, part of the process of beginning to recognize the fact of God the Mother, that there isn't just beautiful little parts that the Father made. There's something else. There's something between the parts that's very subtle to start with. You know, the parts are these solid little things that you can stub your toe on right away. We discovered those long ago. But it's taken us a long time to begin to have a higher sense where it's like, wait a minute, there's also something in between the parts. And the more I step back and get a bigger and bigger vantage point, the more solid it seems to be. It's not as tenuous as I thought when I was just looking at two parts and in between them. I started to step back. It's like this is contiguous out to a large boundary, you know, a universe, you know, one turning. And so if you could step back and see the whole local universe, you would see a collective beauty there that reflects the fact that it's a whole that has an individuality, our creative mother spirit. Okay? So there is a mother nature, but it's not magic matter. It's God the Mother.
We're limited by a very short time frame. Yeah. So we can't see the coordination has taken place over time because we just don't have time to see it. We're just getting a flash.
Plus, she's a descending phenomenon, becoming more and more overtly personal in manifestation in the finite. You know, that full harmony that personality brings into existence is becoming now all the more manifest in our local universe for the last 2,000 years. Remember, she took a notch forward in her transcendence journey of 2,000 years ago. When he became a master's son, she came down into the finite more definitively and is definitively individuated enough now and hence manifestly personal enough now that even lowly beings like us will be able to recognize her personality, her footprint of harmony will be palpable to us now, whereas 3,000 years ago you wouldn't have seen it, you know, ascending in the local universe like you'll see it now. She's moving towards that full individuality, the part where personality now becomes a very definitive manifestation, you know. And always remember to flip that around in understanding yourself. Those who are questing for some intense diffusion into the unity experiences, you know, trying to foster some, you know, mystical unity experience, you're letting go of your individuality. You're letting go of your personality. Your personality is seated on your individuality. If you let go of your individuality to have this fantastic unity experience, that's just an energy experience. That's not a personal experience. Personality is focused down on your individuality. Without your left hemisphere to have individuality consciousness seated on, there's no potential for personality manifestation.
Mm-hmm. Mysticism, the way they're describing it in the book, is you relax first and then you focus. Islands of focus within that very diffuse consciousness.
And
that's the difference, and it's a subtle difference, but it's very important.
And see, what gets focused as a secondary phenomenon like that? Self, an energy fact. See, not a personal fact. He's telling you, you know, if you want a greater relationship with unity, you first need to have a greater personality grip. Or you'll lose yourself in relationship to greater unity. That's why, you know, we aren't immediately put into juxtaposition with intense unity energy. We would just diffuse into it and disappear, okay? We have to build up enough of a personality grip in order to come into juxtaposition with that much unity and not get lost, not get spread to the four corners. All right. Okay, so we're just going to, you know, read these next three little paragraphs, and you'll see why I want to stop here.
the suns. These are the stars of space in all their various stages of existence. Some are solitary evolving space systems. Others are double stars, contracting or disappearing planetary systems. The stars of space exist in no less than 1,000 different states and stages. You are familiar with suns that emit light accompanied by heat, but there are also suns which shine without heat.
The follow-up, again, is in the next section, isn't it? Yeah, the next section. So we'll pick that up next time.
The trillions upon trillions of years that an ordinary sun will continue to give out heat and light well illustrates the vast store of energy which each unit of matter contains. The actual energy stored in these invisible particles of physical matter is well nigh unimaginable. And this energy becomes almost wholly available as light when subjected to the tremendous heat pressure and the associated heat energy activities which prevail in the interior of the blazing suns. Still, other conditions enable these suns to transform and send forth much of the energy of space which comes their way in the established space circuits. Many phases of physical energy and all forms of matter are attracted to and subsequently distributed by the solar dynamos. In this way, the suns serve as local accelerators of energy circulation, acting as automatic power control stations.
Okay. You notice they're pointing out that, you know, you have a very special environment down in the cores of these stars, which allow for certain processes that aren't, you know, going to happen just in open space. Okay. But it all starts out with that very challenging to a typical scientist astronomer. Okay, it doesn't say the billions upon billions of years at an ordinary sun. It says trillions and trillions. Okay, and you know, we've mentioned this many times. That's, you have this full three orders of magnitude that an awful lot of things are off in the current worldview. It's that ignorant. Okay, it's not just a factor of two. Okay, it's at least three orders of magnitude off in many cases. Okay. And the reason that we think that it's billions and billions instead of trillions and trillions why did Carl Sagan love to say billions and billions? Why is billion really the biggest thing, you know, in play? It's because all we know about is the kind of physics that... the nuclei do. We have all kinds of distorted notions about what a nucleus is and what it's actually doing, but that's irrelevant. No matter what our notion is about the nucleus, we can observe it experimentally, and we know what kind of energies are involved, and we think that that's the bottom of the barrel. If you tap into that, you've brought the ladle all the way down to the bottom of the bucket, and there's nothing else to ladle out of that structure. Okay, but there is much more. Okay, there's a whole sub-electronic domain that we know nothing of, and like they're saying, in this very special environment in the core of a sun, you can convert some of that into electronic level energy that, for instance, we observe as heat and light radiating from a star. You can tap into that, okay? And because there's that energy reservoir that we don't know about, you can pretty much, convert it all into something that has a more electronic level manifestation. It can go for trillions and trillions of years. So, you know, all of these... You know, when you look out of the sky, you know, astronomers have this very funny view, when you really recognize it, of what they think they're seeing. You know, they're thinking that they see billions and billions, but the really easy things to see, the really big, bright stars, they don't think they're seeing billions and billions. They think they're seeing millions and millions there. They think that the grand monarchs of space are just flashes in the pan. They last just a few million years. Nah, trillions and trillions. You know, just think of how transformative it was when we went from thinking that the Earth was 6,000 years old to thinking that it was some millions or something, you know, let alone billions. Okay, it was very transformative to many worldviews. Not all worldviews. I mean, you can always, and I can tell you trillions and trillions, and you can say, no, I refuse to believe that. It's only millions and millions. But if we could look out at the heavens with that in our minds, that what you're looking at has been there for almost countless trillions of years, the stability sense that that brings into your inner life, you know, the universe is that stable. Fear not. Okay? Trillions and trillions of years, that star you're looking at has been shining just like you see it.
So what we really have is circulating energy, not just dissipating energy.
Well, I mean, even circulating is one thing, but I mean, just dissipating. There's trillions and trillions of years of dissipation potential.
Yeah,
right. See?
Right.
I mean, if it's in circuit, then it's eternal. Okay, but just in and of itself, what it contains within it is trillions of years of energy production.
I mean, it's kind of in circuit, isn't it? An automaton has it.
Right, it's circuited in the aisle, quote unquote. Yeah, yes. But, all right, so. So that's a very, very important point to let sink in. If you want to be a student of the fifth epical revelation, stop having such a limited viewpoint that's been indoctrinated into you by scientists and our culture. Forget about billions. Billions are nothing. Okay? Nothing of any importance happens in less than a trillion somethings. Okay? You know, just always remember to take what astronomers are telling you with a huge grain of salt, because they have all of these false assumptions. So an awful lot of their conclusions are false. Doesn't matter how many pages of mathematics were involved, the conclusion is false because it starts with a false initial assumption. Okay? You can't take most things at face value. If you're not not interested in digging in, it's probably best to just set it aside. But if you want to actually, I'm interested in this, you'd have some work to do. You need to penetrate into it, figure out what he's assumed in making this conclusion, backtrack, and use the revelation to assess the initial assumption. And, of course, by and large, you're going to refute that initial assumption because it's false. You need to take the correct initial assumption from the revelation and start over again. Okay? Well, I mean, in order to do that calculation, it may have taken many scientists decades of evolution of thinking about it and whatnot. I mean, this is not going to be easy. This is going to take a lot of work for mankind to rework everything, go back to the beginning and rework all this stuff. And it really, the only way that you have what it takes to start such a massive project of reformation like this, is you have enough insight that you have enough insight that you can feel that all is not right. Okay, you have to have enough insight where they can. When they tell you that the universe is 13.75 billion years old, you don't go, wow, four significant digits. This is really accurate. Well, no, maybe completely inaccurate. It might be precise in some false worldview. You have to be able to just hear that number, 13.75, and go, yeah, right.
Precisely accurate error.
You have to be able to respond to 13.75 exactly the way you respond now to 6,000.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is completely ludicrous that the universe is basically just twice as old as the Earth. I mean, think about it. How ridiculous a thought that is. When you look out at the heavens, you know, is that what it feel like? Is that what it feels like to you? It's like, wow, we were basically there at the beginning. I mean, really? Okay, it's just a ludicrous. Yeah, I mean, it's a reductio ad absurdum. If you have any genuine insight, you know that you've made a false assumption. It can't be that young. That just doesn't make sense. In the same way that you're studying all the geologic beds and understanding the speed of geologic processes, erosion and stuff, and you're going, no, what I'm seeing here doesn't fit into 6,000 years. Okay, what you're seeing in the heavens doesn't fit into 14 billion years. That's nonsensical. So do you need just independent thinking? Courageous. Yeah, you need courageous and independent cosmic. You need to put, you know, you have to be willing to put truth, you know, before prestige or whatever, you know. So trillions upon trillions. And it's not like this is just some goofball writing this who thought billions was too small and they wanted to say trillions. You go to paper 41 and 42, they back up that statement. They give you what you need to recognize how it could be trillions and not billions. Okay, one more thing here.
And so I would love to try to imagine the unit of time they really use. You know, how many turnings is that around what? Around.
Well, you know, the basic universal one is what we call 1,000 years.
Yeah.
That's a day.
Yeah.
You know, and so when they talk about millennia of their days, you know, we've mentioned that. Okay, now that's some serious time.
Okay. Right. Trillions and trillions, and their trillions are our trillions.
Well, millennia and theirs would be a million.
Yeah, well, this is our trillions. Yeah. All right, now this last tiny little, is not just a tiny little paragraph. We're going to want to talk about this, so that's why we want to keep going here. This last little bit is an important little tidbit.
Okay, here we go. The super universe of Orvantan is illuminated and warmed by more than 10 trillion blazing suns. These suns are the stars of your observable astronomic system. More than 2 trillion are too distant and too small ever to be seen from Urantia. But in the master universe, there are as many suns as there are glasses of water in the oceans of your world.
Okay, now, There's a lot more than meets the eye here. It's a fascinating little paragraph, and I want to show you why. But first of all, we've mentioned this a couple times. You know, scientists have no idea how big the Milky Way is, okay? It's not some billions of stars. It's 10 trillion, okay, stars in the Milky Way. So that kind of gives you sort of a basic benchmark how many stars you have in an object of this size. Okay. Now, the little analogy there about glasses of water in the oceans, okay, is taken from human source work. Okay. Back in the 30s, there was a very popular public work written by a physicist and philosopher named William Swan called The Architecture of the Universe. Just the title is kind of interesting. Not surprisingly, they used this many, many, many times as a human source work starting point. This particular analogy is directly out of here. Let me read you that. Swan says, so he's starting a chapter talking about the universe, and he wants to give the reader a sense of just how many stars there are. And he says, the number of stars in the grander universe is possibly about 10,000 million million million. In other words, there are about as many stars in the grander universe as there are glasses of water in all the oceans of the world. Okay? Now, there's a number of interesting things about what they did with that little, you know, passage there. Notice they used the analogy pretty much directly.
They converted it to 10 trillion.
They didn't. They didn't use his estimate of an actual number. Okay. No, not 10 trillion. No, that's a different thing.
Oh.
We're not talking about the number of stars in the Milky Way.
Total.
Talking about the number of stars in the master universe.
Total.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, 10,000 million is 10 times 10 to the 21. Okay. And the reason why I'm not saying 10 to the 22, think of it as 10 times 10 to the 21. So a 10 and then 21 zeros after it. Okay. It's a really big number. Okay. Now, you can do this simple little calculation like he did. You can look up an estimate. Scientists have estimated how many cubic kilometers of water there is in the oceans of the world. You know, and you can divide the volume of that water by the volume of a glass of water, you know, 8 ounce or 12 ounce or whatever you want to assume for your glass size. Okay. You know, and you'll see you get a number, you know, like this. You'll get a number, you know, a few times 10 to the 21. So this is kind of, he sort of rounded up, you know, to 10 times 10 to the 21. You know, just recognizing it's a very direct use of a human source work. You know, it's not some mystical statement.
Does he have the rest of, have you read the whole paper? Is he pretty on in a lot of spots?
Well, I mean, he basically just knows what they knew back in the 30s. But, okay, remember, you're not looking, oh, it's another revelation. No, human source works aren't another revelation. They're human source works. They just know, you know, the human that wrote it just knows what humans know. But the human that wrote a particular human source work said things in certain ways. It's like, ooh, that's a neat way he said that. You know, or the very fact that he called his book The Architecture of the Universe. Okay, you don't have architecture without a creator, see? Okay, see, that's telling you right away that it might be interesting to read this. It might be good for some human source works if I'm a revelator and I want to, you know, play off of something. Someone who thinks enough of the universe to call it an architecture. And sure enough, he's used many times as a launch point, some way he said something, especially his analogies. He did some fun analogies that they used directly like this. Okay? All right. But the fascinating thing is to notice some of the details. Okay? Okay, first of all, what I was just saying about the numbers. You know, they want you to actually do the calculation. They don't want to just give you this really rough number that Swan gave there, one significant digit sort of number. You do the calculation yourself. Like I said, you'll get, if you take, a 12-ounce glass of water, you know, if your glass of water is the size of this glass right here, how many of those are in the ocean? You'll get a number that, if you assume, as you get this huge number of stars, divide that into galaxies that are 10 trillion stars apiece. You know, obviously they're all different sizes and whatnot, but just, you know, standardize a standard galaxy. Assume that that's a standard nugget. So divide it by 12 trillion. You'll get a number very close to the number of galaxies they told you that when you get your telescopes get better, you'll find out to basically the build radius of 300 million light years. Remember when they told you back in paper 12 that there was 375 million galaxies? You'll get a number just almost spot on to that. Now, if you assume it's an 8-ounce glass, okay, you're going to get a little bit more. And, of course, there are, you know, some more galaxies in the other, sort of the outer half of the second outer space level. you know, who knows how many, maybe it could be a couple hundred million more out there or something, you know, and there aren't going to be as many stars in a lot of those. What, you know, the whole point is you'll get numbers that are right in the range of kind of telling you somewhere between how many definitively you have out to the build diameter, you know, or the build radius of 300 million light years, or ones that would, you know, include the rest of the second outer space level. You get numbers that are just exactly like what they tell you are out there. Just making that crude assumption of dividing it into equal chunks of 12 trillion stars per galaxy. So it works really well. It's very, very interesting how well it works. But even cooler is, get a little bit of etymology. Okay, in the Urantia book, we have two big universe terms that they use. Grand universe and master universe. Okay. Grand means great. Now, the Latin word grandis has become our word grand. Okay? And the Latin word grandis just means great. Okay? And it's a more recent Latin word. The older one is for great is magnus. Okay? If you take that older word, okay, you know, you think, you know, we always often want to talk about things, well, that's a great thing. Oh, yeah, well, that's a greater thing. You know, we want to use a double comparative. You know, we want to use the word greater. Well, the Romans did that. They had great and they had greater. Okay, their word greater comes down to us. You know, it's coming from the M word. It's the word we call master. Magister. I mean, it's Magnus is great. Greater is, okay, ends up, you know, it ends up with an E-R on the end, okay, like master, okay, great and greater. Mast and master, okay. You have grand universe and master universe. Put them on common terms. That's great and greater. You know, there's the great universe and there's the greater universe. Okay. Okay. So that's one way to look at it. But now what if you did it the other way? What if you said, well, you know, there's the grand universe and then there's the grander universe. Instead of calling it the master universe, you could call it the grander universe. What did Swan do? Okay, just look at it. In other words, there are about as many stars in the grander universe as there are glasses of water in the oceans of the world. But in the master universe, there are as many stars as there are glasses of water in the oceans of your world. Wow. That's how close the two sentences are. Yeah. Yeah. See, they said so in grander, they used master, same word. Yeah. I mean, so the very fact that Swan set up the sentence almost spot on is very interesting. I mean, it indicates someone who is really reflecting. You know, like I said, he has to be reflecting. What's the title of his book? The Architecture of the Universe. It's very fun to notice what a very reflective, insightful person can come up with. They can get pretty close. It felt right to him to call it the grander universe. Yeah. So it's a fun little human source work tidbit. And brush up on your division. Try it, you know. Go to Wikipedia, find the volume of the oceans, figure out how to convert, you know, fluid ounces to cubic meters and divide the two numbers. See what kind of a number you can get. See, try it out. You know, it's just a simple. All you need is two numbers and divide them. See if you can get a number on that order. Something times 10 to the 21. Just so you can feel the size of what we're talking about here. Okay. Yeah. And you divide that number by 10 trillion, and you still have hundreds of millions. You know. Okay. All right. It's a really big number. All right, let's Let's take a moment here to reflect on that.